This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, they're called torch teams, transit operational response with canine and heavy weapons.
I had trouble believing the story when I heard it. Canine units, dogs, and automatic machine guns on our subway cars.
We'll interview author Darius Rejali on his new book, Torture and Democracy.
If you think that torture originated in fascist states, you're wrong. Democracies played a key role in the development of torture and torture techniques.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Last week, the Supreme Court, in a really shocking opinion, upheld the Indiana voter ID law. That's a voter ID law that requires you to have a picture ID, essentially issued from the state or the federal government, that says you have a right to vote and who you are. Basically says, identifies you. And this is very unusual because up until this time, you had not been required to have a picture ID to vote. And I think the way the sides lined up show you what's at stake here. Republicans, right-wingers wanted to have a voter ID. Democrats and other liberal forces said, no, you don't need a voter ID because we've never had a problem in the past, and there's no evidence that there's widespread or any fraud with regard to people voting. And despite that, the Supreme Court said voter ID is reasonable in a voting context. And I think the best line I read in it was by one of the dissenters that said, this majority would have upheld the poll tax if it had come to them today, which is this should really be looked at like a poll tax, because the people who have to get the voter IDs are people who don't have driver's licenses because they either don't want to drive or can't get driver's licenses or don't have passports, and only a small percentage of the country has passports. So you're talking about having to go through some kind of special process, which makes it very difficult, which means the voting is going to go down, really, for less affluent people.
And let's talk about who is affected. The elderly, those who are members of racial minorities, individuals with disabilities, it's hard for them to get or carry a photo ID. The NAACP came out with a statement on this, which echoes what you said about poll taxes, Michael. They said that mandated photo ID programs would create a modern-day poll tax for voters throughout the country. Even if states provided everyone of voting age with an ID at no charge, they could not guarantee that every poll worker would apply the mandates in a fully equitable manner. So this is making it difficult for those who don't have IDs to vote, and it's anti-democratic.
Well, just keep in mind, though, it only applies so far to Indiana.
But states, particularly those controlled in any way by Republicans or legislatures that are not as liberal, are going to start passing voter IDs because they recognize it's a way of disenfranchising people who might vote for the Democrats or for liberals or for the new party or for whatever else is different than the Republicans. So this, we're going to see this possibly sweeping the country. It just tells you, when we talk about democracy in this country, from money to chads to electronic voting machines to all of that, how difficult it is to really get a fair vote.
sort of flies in the face of the 1965 Voting Rights Act put into place to guarantee that no federal, state, or local government would in any way impede or discourage people from registering to vote.
I think that's a really important point, Heidi. That act came out really out of the blood of the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
The old days when they used to make people count soap bubbles in a sink and had a poll tax, all of those kinds of things are what that act was about. And here we're seeing really the Supreme Court uphold a law that really cuts against the core of that act. We're going backwards on this issue.
Can you think of one thing we're not going backwards on?
That's a good question for our audience. If people do, they should send us emails. There's got to be something we're not going backwards on. Oh, my gosh.
Here's one thing we're going forward on. Listeners will be glad to know they're going to build a Disneyland outside of the Green Zone in Baghdad.
Just what the people of Iraq need.
They're taking a park, 50 acres, palm trees, ponds, the place where Iraqis would go even on a Sunday with their family. They're privatizing the park. They've brought in the notion of privatization, as we know, with respect to the oil. But now they're doing it to the land, and they're privatizing this land, and they've got the corporation that does designs and entertainment for Disney putting up a 50-acre park, the centerpiece of which will be a skateboard area. They're raising money to get 200,000 skateboards because they want to introduce the youth culture to the children of Iraq, who in a statement they say deprived and bored, and they want to help them out.
So what do we think is wrong with it? I mean, you know, we have it for our kids here. You know, we occupy the Green Zone. We want to help the kids.
I think the Iraqis who established the first great human culture on the planet and lost it to the American bombing should have a say-so in this. You remember when they did the shock and awe, and before that they knocked out all the Iraqi museums, the patrimony of humanity. We're all looted. And now, instead of allowing the Iraqis to develop their own culture, to keep their own culture, they're bringing in this plastic Disneyland.
Well, it's a cultural thing. It's also, if you look at a financial and what should be the priorities. I mean, they don't have electricity in large parts of Iraq and Baghdad. They don't have good health care. They don't have good schools. And, you know, there's all these internal refugees as well as external refugees. And they're talking about maybe making people try and forget about it, you know, by building some Disneyland.
It's clearly a distraction. And some, including Fox News, said that this is a market signal that the arrow is pointing up. So I think the danger is that it distracts from the terrible conditions there and paints a sort of glossy image.
I think the solicitude of the Disney executives that they're doing something for the children of Iraq was really disgustingly misplaced. I remember Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes interviewing Madeleine Albright, and she said to Albright, "Madam Secretary, we understand that the sanctions, remember the sanctions in the 90s that the Clinton administration brought on, the sanctions have caused the death of 600,000 Iraqi children. Madam Secretary, do you think this was worth it?" And she said, "Yes, I do. It was worth it." This is their real attitude towards Iraqi children. If you can't kill them, you at least try to make a profit off of them.
I do think Heidi's point, and we can close on it, is a very good one, which is that they're trying to show the American people, it may have nothing to do with the Iraqis, but trying to show the American people that life is normal in Iraq and in Baghdad. See, you can have kids go to Disneyland. And it gives this feeling that, you know, the so-called surge has worked. Previously, we have talked about Cheney's role in the torture conspiracy, about the fact that his lawyer Addington and others had meetings at the White House to actually approve various kinds of torture. And now comes a new issue with regard to Cheney, his claim that there's no way the legislature, the Congress, can inquire into anything the vice president can do. They can inquire into what the president does. They can inquire into what the treasurer can do. They can inquire into other cabinet posts. But somehow the vice president, on this theory, is even above the president. Heidi, what is this? What's going on here?
Cheney's lawyer, her name is Catherine Wheelberger, says that the power of Congress to legislate isn't limitless, and therefore neither is Congress's power to inquire. She's basically saying Congress lacks a constitutional power to regulate what a vice president communicates in the performance of his or her official duties, or what that vice president recommends that a president communicate in the president's performance, and therefore those matters aren't within the committee's power of inquiry.
Basically, I have someone who stands outside of the entire structure of inquiry in this government. He's basically a god looking down on the planet.
It's just another aspect of huge growth of the executive at the expense of the judiciary and the legislative branch of the government. It's their notion of the unitary executive. He's the commander in chief, and so is his vice president.
Worse than that, even in a way.
But let me just add that John Conyers, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, responded to the lawyer's assertion and her rationale. And he quoted Supreme Court Justice John Harlan, who said that, in fact, the power of inquiry has been employed by Congress throughout our history, over the entire range of national interests concerning what Congress may legislate, and that he feels it's totally appropriate in this case. Conyers also noted that many White House officials have testified before committees of Congress.
One of our supporters and a frequent guester, Lori Arbeiter, designed a T-shirt. The T-shirt said in white letters on a black T-shirt, "Arrest Cheney first." And Lori told me that when she got on the airplane, all the passengers started clapping, including the stewardesses.
Just another nice moment. Last week we had the annual reception for the Center for Constitutional Rights. And one of the firms we honored was Covington & Burling, who are working on the Turkmen case, which concerns the internal roundups of Muslim men after 9/11. And they put in, Covington is a major law firm, put in hundreds of hours. And the partner who made the presentation was absolutely extraordinary. He actually had us in tears. And he was willing, this is Covington & Burling, to say that the Bush administration was a criminal administration.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a shocking presentation to see that this law firm, which, you know, is the one of the half a dozen major law firms in the country, sees this administration in the same way that a lot of our listeners do.
You know, it was such a shot in the arm to hear him say that. Here are people that are actually upholding the rule of law. This used to be the backbone of the American Bar Association, which we all thought American Bar Association is these stodgy Republicans. We had nothing to do with them. They haven't changed much, but since the administration has moved so far to the right, the American Bar Association and people like the Covington partner are the ones that are upholding the rule of law, and it's good to have them on our side.
I was moved by them tremendously and how important they considered the Roundup cases to be after 9/11 and how much work they put in. At least 10 people showed up at the center's reception from Covington, which was shows they have a huge commitment to this case.
That was great. There are idealistic young law school graduates who get jobs in these major firms. They're really smart, and they want to do something good. Firms like Covington are giving them the chance, and they're doing it.
It was exciting. A couple of weeks ago, our own Heidi Boghossian described how undercover policemen and a canine unit were intimidating a subway rider on the platform with a canine unit barking viciously near his face. We'll have a follow-up on that story today, and we'll also talk about the teams of police that are armed with MP5 machine guns, body armor, and bomb-sniffing dogs now patrolling the subway systems of New York. They're called Torch Teams. TORCH is an acronym for Transit Operational Response with Canine and Heavy Weapons. The teams plan daily patrols on Penn Station, Herald Square, Columbus Circle, Rockefeller Center, Times Square, and Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. If we needed a good example of how the United States is slipping into a police state, this is it. We talked today with Attorney Jonathan Moore with the National Police Accountability Project, a project of the National Lawyers Guild.
Welcome to Law and Disorder, John.
Thank you.
So last week, the NYPD launched its new anti-terrorism effort called Operation Torch. It's frightening to a lot of people because officers with MP5 machine guns, M4 carbine rifles, body armor, and bomb-sniffing canine units can, as I understand it, patrol the cars of the New York subways.
This is a recent program designed to, in the words of Raymond Kelly, it's a reasonable expenditure of funds to deal with the threat of terrorism. They're spending $30 million out of an allocated $153 million from Homeland Security to the state of New York to fund this program, which is five or six teams a day of police officers carrying the weapons you mentioned, having a dog with them, working 12-hour shifts in very confined spaces because they're in the subways and the stations and the cars. You have to wonder, and we haven't heard it yet from the police department, why Kelly concluded this was a reasonable expenditure of funds.
You're saying they're in the subways with what kind of guns are they?
Machine guns, M4 carbines, body armor with, you know, the helmets that the soldiers wear, carrying these very large and vicious dogs.
Oh, are the dogs muzzled when they're in there?
We don't know.
It's very odd to me. I think if I were a terrorist, I'd just avoid those people and go to a different car.
It's like the bag search program that they had,
right.
Which was challenged unsuccessfully, of right. course. But nevertheless, they never were able to demonstrate how the bag search program actually stopped terrorism or aided the any effort to stop terrorism. There were no arrests. And as far as I know, there have never been any significant arrests as a result of the bag search program.
Well, Jonathan, what about just the notion that having these people with submachine guns and body armor and dogs down there just scares people?
In a confined space.
There must be a reason for this. Maybe there are terrorists out there. It just ratchets up the fear and makes people easier to scare and control.
Well, I think in my experience, and it goes back decades, a couple of decades of litigating significant civil rights cases against the city of New York and the New York City Police Department, what bothers me about this is the same thing that bothered me about the street crime unit that killed Amadou Diallo and these undercover units that killed Sean Bell and wounded his two compatriots is a question about, are they really being adequately trained and supervised? I mean, here you have the Sean Bell incident where six officers fire 50 times at unarmed people in a wide open space. What's going to happen with untrained, unsupervised officers in subway cars and confined spaces of subways with submachine guns, the lack of training and supervision, and something happens? It's really not a question of whether something is going to happen. It's a question of when.
I agree. You know, that's scary for any of us who ride the subway. Any of us. I mean, when you think about that kind of thing.
And what about people who are terrified of dogs?
You know, so somebody sees a dog, they get up to move, and then they look suspicious because they're leaving.
Furtive,
you know?
Movement.
Well, think about it. I mean, the government says, here, we're going to give you $30 million. So they have to come up with something, you know. Do they use that money to better train the officers on the use of force? Do they use that money to better train officers on when to stop people and search them on the streets? And we've seen a huge increase in the last 4 years of suspicionless stops and frisks on the street. Are they using that money to do that when there's clearly a need for it? No, they're using it basically to dress people up as robocops to make it look like they're doing something to deal with the war on terrorism, when in reality it's window dressing. It's just show. And it's show for two reasons. One, look at, we're really doing something. And two, there's a dangerous threat out here, so you have to relinquish your constitutional rights. This is different times now, and it's the same rationale Bush has used for Guantanamo, the same rationale John Yoo or Wu or whatever that guy's name is at Berkeley uses in his memos justifying the suspension of constitutional rights.
You mentioned oversight a little while ago. Are there any consent decrees in place in the city now to monitor police misuse of force?
As a result of the street crime litigation, the city was required to adopt a policy against racial profiling and doing stops and frisks. We don't even know how effective that is because they resisted any effort to really try to monitor it. And so there is now a new case that has been filed to try to get at the truth as to whether they have actually adopted and implemented a policy against racial profiling and stops and frisks. As far as I know, I don't think there's an actual consent decree or judgment that speaks to the question of excessive force. You remember some years ago, the federal government was investigating the use of force by the New York City Police Department, but under this administration, it went nowhere. So unfortunately, there isn't.
Is there anything you're thinking of doing about Operation Torch?
It's something that is difficult because you need plaintiffs to come forward who say they've been stopped, they were threatened, they were threatened by the dogs, threatened by a submachine gun being put in their face, and we don't have those yet. But if there are enough instances, and not just an isolated instance, but enough instances of people having their rights violated by this group, then of course we would try to step in and do something about
it. This operation has actually begun already.
It's in place.
And did you say what TORCH stands for?
Something having to do with canines and
here, transit operational response right. with canine and heavy weapons.
Oh my gosh.
That's what it stands
for.
This
is in our subway system.
Jonathan,
wow.
Consider this, and what's your reaction to it? The president of the city chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, mm-hmm. our friend Danny Myers, wrote in response to the verdict out there in Queens that the budget for the New York City Police Department is $7 billion a year. $30 million to put dogs and Tommy guns out in the subway cars is a drop in the bucket.
It's a drop in the bucket, but more importantly, it's a dangerous drop in the bucket because everybody has concluded, even Michael Bloomberg said it appeared there was a use of excessive force in the Sean Bell incident. The Judge Cooperman, in his decision exonerating the officer, said, I'm not going to address the incompetence of the police department and how this operation went down. So if you have a police department that pays little attention to how they train and supervise their officers, this is a tragedy waiting to happen. And with Tommy guns and dogs and M4 rifles and confined spaces, it's going to be much worse than Sean Bell.
The confined spaces is a unique situation, I think. Do you know of any other police departments around the country that bring canine units onto confined spaces such as buses or subways?
I think this is the first operation of its kind.
This is really amazing. I mean, I just think about my kids. I remember, you know, within a few years after 9/11, when you went to the subway, at the front of the subway, at least outside, there were guys in uniforms and guns. And I was already appalled by that. But the idea that they're going to be down on the subways with good
guns.
Well,
as you walk to the studio here today, you see on Wall Street it's a similar program of these officers dressed in combat gear, carrying submachine guns, standing around with their fingers on the trigger.
Jonathan, a couple of weeks ago, we mentioned an incident that I witnessed on a subway. Well, it wasn't a platform, but it was the Union Square subway system where a handler with a canine unit and several other officers had pinned into a corner an African-American man, and they were using the canine unit to what I thought was intimidate and harass after he'd already been apprehended. I understand that's a misuse.
Yeah, that borders on torture. That's what happened in Abu Ghraib, you know, using dogs to intimidate somebody who's in your custody who can't leave. Obviously, the person couldn't leave. And that's very troublesome. That's a violation of the Fourth Amendment for sure.
Whenever I study torture at Abu Ghraib or anywhere else, once they allow the use of dogs, even with muzzles for supposedly moving people around or if they're obstreperous or whatever, people don't look at those lines very well. I mean, they take off the muzzle, the person isn't saying something or isn't admitting something, they bring the dog close to their face. It's just as natural as the sun coming up the next day, and that's what happens when you start using dogs.
See, my concern is that who is watching the people who are watching us, you know? In that situation, if the person wasn't arrested, even if the person was arrested, there should have been what is known as a UF-250 form, a stop and frisk report form, should have been filled out by the police, explaining what the basis was for the stop and the frisking and the questioning of this individual. Was such a form filled out? In the street crime case, the city resisted to the point where we had to file a new case, resisted our efforts to find out what they're doing with the information. Are they getting the information? Are officers filling out the reports? And if they are, what are they doing? Are they auditing it? Are they looking at it to see if there's violations? At this point, we don't know. And they won't tell us. So that suggests that they probably aren't.
They're not filling out a form, which is the stop and frisk form.
Right. If they do, they're not analyzing those stop and frisk forms to see if, in fact, those stops and frisks are constitutional.
One of the things I think that has become apparent with the Sean Bell case, and I think that plays into the issue of oversight, is there seems to be a shift where perhaps young, relatively inexperienced law enforcement officers seem to be defending themselves rather than doing what most people think is their goal, is to defend the public, so that self-defense and firing 50 shots when there's no evidence of a weapon is now being called justified police reaction.
Well, it's not much different than the Amadou Diallo case. I mean, remember, there were 43 shots there. In that situation, in 1999, the officers who first fired were less than 3 feet away from Amadou Diallo and claimed that the wallet he was taking out of his pocket looked like a gun. I don't care what the light is. If you're less than 3 feet away from somebody, you can tell. I mean, you're a police officer. You know what a gun looks like. So my concern is the police department never really learned the lessons from the Diallo case and from the street crime unit. And even though it was disbanded, we believe it's now been reconstituted in a different form throughout the boroughs and these sort of anti-crime units that are now doing the same thing the street crime unit used to do. So they haven't learned, they didn't learn the lesson in Diyala, they didn't learn the lesson in Louima and Dorisman. Why do we expect that they'll learn the lesson in Bell?
And we should mention that Jonathan Moore was one of the attorneys working on the case, Daniels v.
City of New York.
Jonathan was one. Bill Goodman was another with the Center.
And the Center for Constitutional Rights. And the result was the disbanding of the Street Crimes Unit.
Right.
As we knew it.
Right. Whether that was a real meaningful remedy or not, it remains to be seen, unfortunately.
Just like the federal government has pumped in tens of millions of dollars to put dogs and Tommy guns on the subway cars, I began to notice about a year ago that there'd be huge swarms of police cars with their lights on top going, and they'd all gather down in my neighborhood. I have an office down on Vesey Street, right across the street from Ground Zero. And then, like it was coordinated, at the same instant, they would all take off and drive somewhere.
Right.
Or I'd be driving on the FDR and I'd see them all stream by me. And then I read that this is a program that's funded and sponsored by the federal government, pumps money into New York City to do this, to show terrorists the New York City police are prepared. It seems to me that that notion is as preposterous as the notion of putting dogs on subways.
Well, two things about that. One is you're right. Operation Torch, the Hercules operation, the use of these vehicles, they're window dressing. They're a show to make it look like the police department is addressing terrorism, when in reality, they don't lead to arrests. They don't lead to the uncovering of any kind of terrorism. It just doesn't really happen. What it does, it intimidates people, puts fear in people's hearts and in people's minds that we're under a constant siege. So we have to let the police department go a little bit further than what the Constitution allows them. And it's the same argument Bush has made about why the CIA or the military should be allowed to torture, because these are unique times. In those unique times, the Constitution has to be put aside.
Are these unique times? Has there really been evidence of any kind of terrorism in New York City since 9/11? I haven't seen any.
There was one case that came out of that was tried in Brooklyn several years ago involving people who were allegedly plotting to blow up Herald Square. Some of your colleagues were involved in Marty Stolar and
Subway and case, right?
The Subway case.
Subway informant case.
And that was more of an entrapment than a real terrorist plot. There hasn't really been. If there had been, we'd have seen it on the front page of the Post, of course.
Yeah, exactly. But their argument is there hasn't been because what we're doing. And that seems to me as ridiculous as saying I keep a clove of garlic in my refrigerator and I don't have any elephants in my living room.
Well, it's the same argument they made around how they police the Republican National Convention and the creation of this stockade on the west side at Pier 57 and the use of the barbed wire and the use of dogs and the lack of access to lawyers and the no phones, putting people incommunicado for 48 hours for simply parading without a permit at worst. It's the same mentality that in the eyes of the police department, they want nobody on the street doing anything. And unfortunately, these tactics, the window dressing you see is only the tip of the iceberg. What is really going on is a criminalization of dissent in this city and in the country.
You know, I think that's actually a crucial point.
Yeah.
That what's happened really over time, but in the last few years certainly, people are now taking huge risks if they go out and dissent. We just had a lawyer at our office, Darius Charney, go out as a legal observer to the Sean Bell demonstrations in Queens. He got arrested. And not only did he get arrested, he's had to spend the night in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the attorney, clear legal observer. Amazing. So
wearing an
observer.
The green hat.
Yeah, the whole thing. So,
right. Well, they target. We know from looking at a lot of these cases, I've been involved in a lot of them, that they actually target legal observers who wear the lime green hats from the National Lawyers Guild. So there's no justification whatsoever for Darius Charney to have to spend the night in jail disorderly conduct for whatever it may have been.
It's a punishment for dissent.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly right. And that's one. And, of course, it goes all the way to the extreme.
It's more than what any court would ever impose, even if he pled guilty to that.
Exactly right.
So the police are acting as the judge, the jury, and the executioner right on the street. Right.
And it's not just happening in New York. It's happening throughout the country.
Unfortunately,
and
I think that's the
case. And it really is a way of suppressing dissent in a very broad way. I know you do police work. You've done it for years, mm-hmm. from Chicago to New York. Your reaction to the Sean Bell killing as well as to the verdict in the trial?
Well, two things. One is the, what I mentioned before, that it's an example of how the police department puts officers in situations where bad things can happen. And they won't deal with that because they want their officers to be aggressive on the street. And they won't do it. It's like they wouldn't discipline the officers in the street crime unit. The other thing is, it's hard to understand how these officers could have fired 50 times and that not have been some kind of reckless endangerment or some violation of the New York penal law. It defies belief. And you have to believe, although you'll never be able to prove it, that they knew what they were getting when they took a bench trial in front of that judge in Queens.
Yeah, you have to believe it.
Right.
You have to
either
believe
they move the case out, like they did in the Diallo case, move it to Albany, where they get a jury that thinks New York is, you know, the front lines of the war on terrorism, or they get a judge. They will not subject what they do to the will of the people.
That's exactly
I think that's
right.
A really important point. Well, thank you, John.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks,
keep up
John.
Your amazing work.
We'd like to let our audience know about a special event that's going to happen in just a couple of hours. Today, Monday, May 5th, from 3:30 to 5:30, the Brennan Center for Justice presents an event called The Constitution Comes Home. Constitutional lawyer David Cole, attorney Sean Mayer, and Faisal Hashmi will discuss the case of Syed Fahad Hashmi and the state of civil liberties. The event will be held at Brooklyn College at the Jefferson Williams Brooklyn College Student Center on Campus Road and East 27th Street in Brooklyn. For information, call 718-951-5847. Listeners of Law & Disorder will recall that we interviewed Syed Fahad Hashmi's father and Sean Mayer on a program about a month ago. It's an important case that you'll really want to hear about.
Here on Law & Disorder, we've taken an in-depth look at torture with various authors and guests, including Al McCoy, Mania Lazreg, Flint Taylor, Andre Alleg. Today, we speak with Reed College professor Darius Rajali, author of the book Torture and Democracy. In this book, Rajali tracks behaviors, trends, and traditions that have brought torture to where we see it today. Rajali is the leading expert on government interrogation techniques. He argues that torture is an ancient craft and technique passed on from teacher to apprentice. He says knowledge of the torture craft often flows both ways, between colonial powers and occupied peoples. This is a powerful book filled with information on techniques. One review writes, "This book lays the groundwork. Torturers and their keepers may find it useful, not as an academic study, but as a field manual." We're joined today by Professor Darius Rajali. Welcome to Law & Disorder.
It's really great to be here.
Well, all of us here are so impressed with the new encyclopedia on torture that you've put together in Torture and Democracy. It's a magnificent work. And before we talk about some of the details, you have a few key conclusions, notably that when human rights abuses are monitored internationally, it doesn't stop torture. In fact, it results in torturers changing their techniques to ones that don't show, that leave physical abuse.
That's right. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes human rights monitoring works clean up and act. It's really not hard to stop torture. It really takes government's willingness to work with human rights workers and medical monitors and so forth And when governments do so, they can pretty much put an end to most torture in their system, but many governments don't. And so they want to appear compliant to international norms if you're an authoritarian state, or to legal norms if, you know, you're a democratic state. And so they prefer to use cleaner techniques. And the whole value of techniques that don't leave too many marks is that a victim's testimony that torture has happened is less credible. So nobody really believes this person unless they are more familiar with the process. So clean techniques allow governments basically to be hypocrites, to, on the one hand, appear to be compliant, but not, in fact, compliant in practice. And what the book documents is a 200-year history of clean techniques, and it argues that over time, these techniques have become much more common. First, these techniques appear in democracies, and this is generally not well appreciated, is that it was in democracies where people started, police in particular, started reaching for these techniques because we had human rights monitors and press and lawyers. And basically, when we watch, the cops get sneaky. I mean, it's that's really, in some sense, the nutshell story of the book. But what happens is that in the 1960s, as we get a world human rights regime where Amnesty International is doing an annual audit of torture in the 1970s, even authoritarian states start becoming cleaner. And so these techniques start spreading very fast. Electro-torture doubles every decade from 1960 onwards. Around the world. So there's a contagion effect. So that's the main claim of the book.
Yeah, that was, I think, extraordinary. I mean, what I read it as saying is that essentially the clean techniques have been developed out of democracies and out of human rights monitoring.
Some of the techniques are older. I mean, I'm sure everyone's going to say, yeah, waterboarding comes from the Spanish Inquisition, and that's true. But you have to understand that these very older techniques only held very small niches. I mean, the reason Catholic priests liked waterboarding was they didn't really like a lot of blood. Right? There were the ritualized roles. Slave dealers, for example, also were clean sometimes because marks on a slave reduced the price. So we can find some examples of cleaner techniques, but it's important to remember that pretty much for most of human history, the standard torture techniques have been whips and racks and things that are very bloody. And what we're finding is that those scarring techniques are gradually disappearing. Nobody remembers that the standard Nazi technique in Western Europe all the way to Norway was the leg clamp, which breaks your bones. But no one uses leg clamps today. But everybody uses electro-torture, sleep deprivation, and many of those techniques, however rare, were then spread by democracies or first got their characteristic use in the 20th century by democratic states, their colonies or somewhere else.
Now, Darius, that brings us to another sort of key point that is made throughout the book, that the practice of torture, the traditions have been passed down much like crafts, craftsmen sharing how they practice torture. And you do say that this goes from both colonial powers and occupied peoples, this practice of sharing.
That's right. I mean, most people kind of think, well, the techniques that a torturer uses, it's got to come from his own abnormal psychology. But actually, torturers tend to be very normal people.
That's a really good point, yeah. A really strong point.
You know, I mean, organizations don't hire sadists because those guys are disciplinary problems. They don't obey the rules. They kind of weed them out. And we found this out through studies of torturers in Greece and Brazil. Torturers are organization men. And one of the things that then follows from that is that, well, where do they get their techniques from? And one of the things that we discover is that they basically do a lot of on-the-job training. And there are a lot of reasons why networks of whispers and backroom apprenticeship is a valuable thing. You know, if you did this all out in public with manuals and stuff like that, everybody would notice. The whole point of having an underground tradition is that it should remain underground. And so a lot of this stuff gets passed on just the way like someone learns tailoring or massage. I mean, both activities that deal with the body. And you can get really good tailors who have suits for you, and you have one-size-fit-all tailors just like that. You can have torturers who are stupid and treat everybody exactly the same, and you can have really cruel and malicious ones. But basically, they're doing the technique in the same way. And a couple of things I find. The other thing is that there are two traditions that come out of clean techniques. One, the main tradition is the French tradition, which is the combination of electricity and water, which we see in a lot of movies. and I call that French modern. And the other one is much older, goes to the 19th century Anglo-Saxon modern, which is a combination of sleep deprivation, what we call stress and duress techniques, forced standing, forced sitting, various sorts of exhaustion exercises, basically a lot of former military punishments that are illegal now but which are being used for these purposes. So these are everything that we've seen sort of worldwide is one of these two traditions. There are other traditions. The Soviet tradition of the psychoprison exists, but it's kind of rare.
To me, what was stunning about this really is that many of us, depending on sporadic news stories and recent revelations, kind of perhaps thought of torture as an anomaly or just happens here and there. But this shows how really it's institutionalized in all of these countries on such a wide scale with the range of techniques that you document. You've referred to a few, but you really include many more in the book. And that, to me, is a very sad commentary, the fact that ordinary people are passing these traditions on.
It is true. I think the danger of violence always lies with us. I'll tell you a story. I was writing this book, and my editor was reading it, and he came across a technique that was developed by the New York police in the 1920s called the necktie, where they straightened a guy's necktie till he turned blue in the face or confessed, right? And he said, "Oh my God, this is what used to happen to me in boarding school in Canada every day." And he's like, "Well, yes, and this is exactly where torture techniques go to hide during periods of good monitoring, is that the cruelty hides in military barracks and schools and fraternity hazing, and ordinary people pass these techniques on to each other. And when the top authorizes them to do this, then they come running with everything that they've fantasized doing. And that's an unfortunate fact, and it just means that the fight against torture is also a fight against all the dark places in our society that we really need to keep an eye on, including schools and military systems and other things like that.
Darius, hi, this is Michael Smith. We're speaking, for those who just have tuned in, to Darius Rajali, who wrote this comprehensive, really encyclopedic book called Torture and Democracy. Just came out, Princeton Press. We urge everybody to get it. Isn't it true that the CIA spent a lot of time and money in the 50s and 60s unearthing and developing and refining these techniques?
There is definitely, and I talk about this in the book, the work of Dr. Cameron and the sensory deprivation techniques. Their main interest was in brainwashing and the role of these techniques in brainwashing. And they concluded, I think correctly, that these techniques don't work for brainwashing. They went on and did a very, and I again document this in this book, a very large sort of study on the use of drugs, which also kind of came to the conclusion that they couldn't use drugs for a lot of purposes, like brainwashing. But let me get to the bigger question, which is torture a science or is it a craft? I make an argument that it's a craft, not a science. And basically my argument is roughly like this. If torture doesn't work, which is certainly the argument I make, then it's not a science. If it's a science, then it should work. If torture is a
meaning reliable evidence is derived from it.
It should get you reliable evidence, and you should be able to get precisely exactly the right amount of pain. If torture really is a science, you should be able to regulate it, and you shouldn't have any of the terrible slippery slope effects that torture produces. But we clearly have documented numerous slippery slope effects. Once someone authorizes it, the whole place runs out of control, partially because pain is one of those incredibly flexible mechanisms. And torturers basically soon recognize that unless the nature of pain itself changes, there won't be a science about pain. And this is one of there are many mythologies about what pain is. People think that it's all of a sort. But most torturers know that pain is, first of all, culturally variable. It is also, there are different qualities of pain, burning pain, different kinds of sensations. And so there's never been a particular kind of way to identify everything that drives a person to distraction and pain. So what they do is they completely break the rules. They do scatter shots. They try and overtake a person's pain threshold, which the more they torture, and this is another thing I document in the book, people's pain threshold starts going up. That is to say, you feel less pain the more you're tortured. Everyone knows this feeling because when they walk in cold, they gradually become numb. we have very good mechanisms to protect ourselves from pain. Because pain is this very complicated process, and we've never really figured it out. We figured out lots of things that cause pain, and certainly the CIA discussed how drugs and things could cause pain. But to make it a precise, regulated science that they could predict it, we're still some ways away from that. You'll know when we're there, when the slippery slopes disappear and torture starts working.
Duraz, I have a question. I guess it goes to, in some way, the heart of what you're saying, which is that as they developed what you call clean torture techniques as a way of avoiding public scrutiny, that one of the things I've noticed today in our current, what I call the U.S. torture program, is yes, they did a whole series of clean torture techniques. It's a Rumsfeld techniques, et cetera, that I'd want you to address at some point. But in addition, they actually, in some way, want people to know that we're carrying out torture. So you have Cheney saying, nothing wrong with a little dunk in the water, or we'll work the dark side. Or you have them now admitting they have to use water torture or waterboarding, as they referred to it. So I'm trying to figure out how to square that with what you're saying about the use of so-called clean torture in a democracy and what purpose they would have for saying that and doing that.
Right. No, I mean, the peekaboo kind of game that they play is actually not a new one. I grew up in Iran. I'm Iranian, and I grew up under the Shah. And I remember in 1973, Time magazine interviewed the Shah of Iran, and they said, do you torture in your country? And he said, oh, we don't torture like doing this and that and twisting arms, but we have more intelligent ways of asking questions.
Right.
And, it, you know, this is not news. I mean, dictators do this too. And in a way, what the Shah was saying was, I want everybody in this country to know that if you step out of line, you're going to be in trouble. So it was clearly designed for everybody to know. But at the same time, he wanted to say something that could at least meet the bar for international human rights, sort of, you know, he's not actually admitting to torture. And that kind of game is exactly what I'm talking about the hypocrisy of it. You know, the ancient Greeks always used to say this best. They said, tyranny always wears a mask. And occasionally it gives you a glimpse of what could happen to you otherwise. So, I mean, I think, I think people want to get all the benefits of being tough without really fessing up to what they're doing. And what they're doing, I want to be clear, isn't just, you know, torturing, which is bad enough as it is. But I want to be clear, one of the really important effects that I document in this book is torture has a profound deprofessionalizing effect on your police. That is to say, why do the hard work of intelligence when you've got a bat? And police actually become less professional the more they torture. Whistleblowers who could identify fraud and waste in your system start being harassed. Real professionals start leaving because they're disgusted. And not to mention the torturers themselves end up in veterans' hospitals or wherever with serious PTSD syndromes, which nobody wants to acknowledge or pay for that matter. So the cost of this process is terrible.
And that applies, I think, as you say, to general policing techniques, which change what is supposed to be a fact-finding process straight into the adversarial process.
That's right. I mean, torture is perhaps more so than anything else an adversarial process because it also pits police against police, agencies against agencies. And the reason is quite simple. If you're investigating a case and you want to find evidence, say you found the fingerprint and the other guy finds the witness, you can work together potentially on a cooperative basis, right, to make a case. But with torture, all the glory goes to the guy who breaks the prisoner. So it's a zero-sum game, and nobody surrenders their prisoner without beating him up as far as they can, just so that the other guy can get all the credit. So torturers actually develop highly competitive relationships with each other. In Brazil, for example, the different torture units would raid each other's prisons so that they could get the prisoners that they wanted to interrogate. And we've already seen this behavior in several cases in the War on Terror where the FBI was interrogating someone and the CIA came in and snapped them up and they disappeared, right? This kind of intra-agency competition leads to not just adversarial sort of on the external, but internally it creates processes where the bureaucracy starts spinning out of control as each of the units starts operating on their own. And one of the worst parts of the Military Commissions Act that we have is that it creates a parallel system where some people can torture and the CIA, and some people cannot. And if you're one of those guys who cannot, ask yourself, why should you be stuck holding the bad techniques? Sooner or later, you're going to say, let me use some of these clean techniques too and see if I can get away with it. So
I think that's a really important point.
Yeah,
that's really going to the point that we've been discussing in the media right now and in Congress about whether to apply the stricter rules for the Army Field Manual techniques, to the CIA, and the one where McCain actually voted not to apply them.
That's exactly right. I'm very disappointed in that. And I will say that I'll quote a very famous Brazilian journalist who said in the 1970s, if you're going to institutionalize torture or quote-unquote tough interrogation, either all of your police force better do it or none of them. But if you divide them between those who can do it and those who cannot, very soon the torturers and the professionals or the disciplinary types get into a major conflict. In Brazil, what happened was that the torturers got involved not just in torture, but in blackmail, in corruption, in all sorts of things. And eventually they started torturing soldiers who were going through military training. And at that point, the military said it's enough is enough, and they turned the disciplinary military, and they started shutting down or killing the torturers. So this kind of parallel system stuff is going to seep over, and it's not easy to regulate. In fact, just as I said, think about the military interrogator. Why should he be stuck, he would say, doing second-rate techniques when somebody else is allowed to get all the glory with the first-rate techniques, right? They're going to do it.
Let me ask about that, though, you know, because you have a lot in the book, and it's very convincing, about torture not really getting at the truth, essentially, not working in the sense of actually solving crimes,
right,
and leading to other people, et cetera. Why then, I mean, you can go historically, I know you've done great studies of this in the past, but looking at today, why then is our CIA, and at least for a long time, our military, both at Guantanamo, at Bagram, and Abu Ghraib, et cetera, why did they use these methods of mostly clean torture, but why did they torture if it's pretty well known that it doesn't work?
The thing is that most of the research that I gathered together in the book was actually scattered across multiple disciplines. I mean, you and I and many other people who knew this work always knew that it didn't work, but one of the things I show is that governments try not to collect information during wars about whether torture works because usually it's kind of a low priority and nobody really wants to document human rights violations of their own troops. And then secondly, even if they have that data, like the CIA has all the Project Phoenix data, it's always classified.
Project Phoenix, remind our listeners.
Project Phoenix was an interrogation system, highly rationalized system that the CIA had in Vietnam, roughly I think between 66 and 72, in which close to 90,000 people were either interrogated, tortured, or killed. The figures can vary, and there are various historical things about it, but the database itself, which they had, was released but never analyzed until some political scientists recently have analyzed it. So information isn't gathered. If it's gathered, it's not analyzed because of, well, let's face it, legal liability. If we all knew what was happening, people could be charged. So there are a lot of incentives for bureaucrats not to analyze this stuff. And besides, when we talk about torture working, we need to be very clear. Does torture work to get false confessions? Oh, yeah. I mean, Stalin could teach us a few things about that, right? Does torture work to intimidate people and get behavioral compliance? Oh, yeah. But those are not the really important cases of torture working. The really important cases of torture working are cases where we're looking for true intelligence. And there are three kinds of errors that inevitably happen. One is the selection error, which is that basically we select the wrong people to interrogate, and they produce, because they know nothing, they produce a lot of false information which gums up the works. The second is basically that even if we had the right guy and he broke, interrogators turn out to be terrible at distinguishing between truth and falsity. And there's a lot of psychological data that kind of shows how bad we are at that. And lastly, some of the techniques we used in the war on terror, we can actually induce conditions in our torture victims in which they actually believe what they're saying, even though it's not true. My favorite example of this is sleep deprivation. You know, sleep deprivation isn't just one of the most painful things that you can do to a person. Menachem Begin said, when he was subjected to it in Russia, that it was worse than starving to death. But aside from that, it also makes you drunk and very suggestible. So if I ask you 17 questions saying, where are the weapons of mass destruction, you're going to remember where you saw those weapons of mass destruction. This is why witch hunters really love sleep deprivation, because you ask enough times, and very soon they'll tell you about all these pacts with the devil and witchcraft and so forth. The inquisitors, who hated witch hunters because they knew this stuff was completely unreliable. The Spanish inquisitors hated sleep deprivation, and yet this is one of our standard interrogation techniques, and we believe what people say because people say this with incredible confidence, almost like they're hypnotized. There's a lot of error here, and it's unavoidable.
Darius, there are six people in Guantanamo going before the military commissions. The Center for Constitutional Rights has been centrally involved in this and is going to be involved in the defense of two of these people. Mohammed Al-Qahtani, for example, suffered the kind of torture techniques that you document in your book, Torture and Democracy. Mm-hmm. And they're going to try him, and they're going to use evidence that was procured from torture, hearsay evidence, secret evidence, and they're going to ask for the death penalty. And I'd like to know from you what you think of these military commissions and this whole process that's going to take place as the election unwinds.
My view is that we all know how problematic the evidence is gathered from torture. I have no idea how the judges are even going to be able to accept this. Really, the only solution is to remand these people over for regular trials. I mean, I don't know what else to say on that one. We need to establish the rule of law again. And part of this involves sending clear messages to the rest of the world that the rule of law is intact here.
Darius, that's a perfect note on which to end, and I'd like to remind our listeners the book is Torture and Democracy by Princeton University Press. Darius, thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Okay, great. I hope to see you in
Thanks.
New York at one of these things.
I look forward to meeting you.
Okay.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.